As I said in the sermon prompt, the dinner prompt, it's been a tough week in a lot of ways, from the personal to the political. And as I learned from feminist movements over the years, the personal is political, which is on our minds, I think, in a sharper way because of the potential shift of the Supreme Court. But it's so powerful to me to acknowledge that we're not in it alone. We're here together, drawn by God's Spirit to conspire together about a different world, to conspire about another order of things. Conspire literally means to breathe with. So I want to start acknowledging just how much there is for all of us in our bodies, in our days, in our weeks, and breathe together. So just whatever's comfortable for you, take a moment. I like putting my hand on my chest, but take a moment just to center yourself and follow my lead as we take a couple of breaths together to ground ourselves in entry into reflection together about this text. Breathe in deeply and hold it briefly, and then exhale. Try and breathe in so you fill the bottom of your stomach all the way up through your chest. And exhale, sighing if you want. And once more, breathe in fully. And exhale. We knew as we planned it that these weeks of our fall season of challenge would be a challenge. Not only would the themes of right relationship raise lots of issues for us individually, but we knew it would connect us to unfolding and very troubling challenges in our neighborhood, in our nation, in our world. This week's theme for our fall season of challenge is a question about right relationship to money. And so that's no less problematic for us to grapple with. Think about the definition of money. Like one of the most common definitions I found as I looked around was a measure of value generally accepted as a medium of exchange. And I thought about how we say things like, how much are they worth? We might mean with that phrase like a thing, like how much is this thing worth? But we also might mean how much money do those people have? How much are they worth? Money can so easily be connected to power, to status, to ideals of self-worth. And that's a powerful question to sit with. Like, indeed, how much are we worth? And what does our income, our wealth, or our family's wealth have to do with our own sense of worth or value as a person? And I just am, haunted, I guess, by what our society values in terms of who gets paid a lot versus who gets paid a little or not at all. Kelsey Brown, who's the new pastor at Jehu's Table, is coming to preach in our series later in October. And Jehu's Table is named after an African American Lutheran pastor who literally wasn't paid for his work. I once calculated that Joe Mauer, the catcher of the Minnesota Twins baseball team, makes about $72,000 a day. And I and many people in helping professions like mine in New York, on average, get paid that. It's about an average New York teacher salary. Lots of social workers and librarians and case managers and so on get paid that per year. So our society values a pro baseball catcher at 365% of the average teacher or social worker. And then I thought about the societal, generational, structural injustice around money and wealth, like the system of laws that disproportionately kept Black families from home ownership. And we know that's a key to building wealth cross-generationally. While at the same time, a set of laws were in place to help whites to buy homes and to build wealth. So whites on average in the United States have 7 times the wealth of Blacks. And they're almost twice as likely to own their own homes. And those statistics have been getting worse over the past couple of decades, not better. And the numbers are almost as stark for Latinx and Native populations. And though somewhat stark, they're still not equal for those of Asian descent. It's the caste system, just exactly as Isabel Wilkerson describes it in her book, as a skeleton of our society's social inequality. And it adds values to people's place in that system. Supposedly, the intelligent and hardworking are on top, and supposedly, the unintelligent and lazy are on the bottom. And those insidious lies are built into the system to defend it and uphold it. So when these questions of identity in relationship to money come into play for us, things get hard. It's hard to be vulnerable with each other. It's hard to face ourselves and to deal with our stories, especially when there's pain or shame associated with them. And the pain or shame can come from having a lot of money or having very little money. And all the issues around money relate to race and class and gender and more. It's just all of that mixed up in how we struggle with our money stories. And I love that St. Lydia's is a place that wants to be open and hold space for vulnerability, that as our sort of tagline says, we desire to be strong enough to lean on, deep enough to question, challenging enough to change you. And I think in part we do that by our practices, including sharing stories of ourselves. And that means risking vulnerability. It means seeking to hold a safer space for making the risks to share. We had, as a congregation, our first Money Stories retreat with Mika Vandersall, our stewardship and fundraising consultant, and just a longtime friend and partner of St. Lydia's, on this past Thursday night. And part two is coming up this coming Thursday. And a lot of stuff came up for people in those conversations. We saw in bold relief how differently we've experienced money in our families and in our lives now. And even though the people who gathered for St. Lydia's in the park on Saturday had not gone to the retreat, we ended up talking about our money stories nonetheless. And it was just as complicated for those folks. So I think this text that we have for today offers some help in thinking about money in the Jewish and Christian traditions. And at the heart of this text and teaching is our hands. So I just want to pause for a moment and invite you to look at your hands, to just regard them. Look at the top of your hands, the bottom of your hands. To think about what you've done with them and what you do with them. There's a beautiful psalm that ends, "Prosper the work of our hands." And I just think it's a beautiful thing and a loss in this moment that our hands can't touch one another. We can't hold hands. We can't give a hug or a high five or a passing of the peace with our hands. This text that we have today is from Deuteronomy, and rhetorically, Deuteronomy is written as a speech from Moses just before his death, as the people are about to cross the Jordan into the land God promised for them. And this chapter, chapter 15, contains a core aspect of the social ethics of ancient Israel, an ethic that was picked up by all the prophets and that was picked up directly by Jesus. Throughout the passage, Moses refers to hands as a way to talk about this ethic. And I think it's so interesting how it shows up right away in the first verse. Every seventh year, you shall grant remission of debts. The Hebrew word translated remission here is shemitah, which means to let slip out of one's hand. You can imagine holding on to these debts that are owed to you and opening your hand and letting them slip out of your hands, almost as grain would slip out of your hand if you were holding a handful of grain. It's a law that's related to other Sabbath laws, including like letting people and servants and animals and even the land rest every seventh year. Or like the Jubilee year outlined in Leviticus 25, a Sabbath of Sabbath years that calls for release of the captives and liberty for the oppressed and return of the land. The promise in these laws, in this social ethic, is that they will not be like Egypt. There will be no poor in the land, Moses claims, if only they follow God's law, setting clear boundaries around those things that lead to inequality, oppression, and injustice. I think Moses is portrayed as a realist here because later in the text, based on his belief they won't actually do that, he says you'll always have poor present with you. And the reason for that is not because that's natural, it's because their social practices allow it. And the metaphor that comes up again and again in the text is having a tight-fisted or an open-handed way. One is like Egypt and the other is what God is trying to teach God's people. And in Deuteronomy, there's this theme of juxtaposing two ways of being, two ways of living, one that leads to death and the other that leads to life. And so I think this passage is calling for a personal but also a societal posture of open-handedness. My parents, like many of their generation, were influenced by the hardship of the Great Depression era shortages and struggles, but they did not respond to those realities in the same way. My father was tight-fisted with money, and he seemed to enjoy the power of holding the money, the power of the purse. My mom wanted to be open-handed. She wanted to counter my dad. And so she got her own job in order to be able to have the money to do that, to play with generosity. And it influenced me enough that I started growing and selling strawberries and then strawberry pies so that I would have my own money to do what I wanted and not have to like beg or depend on my dad's, not really very interested in giving me money to support what I was doing. I bought my own ski pass and my own stereo. So I grew up with competing money stories about what one does when one has enough. Two different ways of holding one's hand. And as an adult, sometimes I think to my detriment, but mostly to my joy, I try and choose my mom's path just as more fun. It won't surprise you to hear that having money didn't make my dad happy. Giving money or thoughtful gifts, playing with the money, makes my mom happy. And it turns out that research shows that having a lot of money does not make people happy. It's true that not having money contributes to unhappiness simply because you can't provide for your basic needs. And that's just a horrible situation to be in for anyone. But above basic subsistence, what leads to happiness is what people do with their money rather than having more or less of it. So I think it's about the work of our hands and the posture or gesture of our hands. Are they clenched? Are they open? When? And for whom? So I just want to say I'm really glad we're opening this conversation about money and our money stories and the role of money in our life and our congregation and in our country. I think opening a conversation about our money stories means they'll have less power over us. One thing I know is that St. Lydia's is full of open-handed people, people whose prayer and action are animated by a spirit of generosity. It's a generous congregation, and one of the remarkable things is the strides that we've made towards being self-sustaining as a relatively new congregation. We've got to a point where only about a quarter of our budget comes through a grant from the wider church. And part of our challenge this year is to end that dependence on the institutional church for our livelihood. financial independence from the institutional church structures will open new possibilities for St. Lydia's, both open-handedness in outreach and justice work and open-handedness in our identity, freed from those connections that, in a sense, are controlling around where we have to get our funding. So let's find ways to speak about our own money stories as stories of our hands and what we do with them. And let's continue to explore what being open-handed might mean individually and as a society. We share the sermon.